obligation, opportunity, and pride.
Hey, 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 brave ones. Welcome back to the Brave Files podcast. I'm your host, Heather Vickery. And did you hear? I'm so excited. Applications are now being accepted for my brand new coaching experience, the Brave Entrepreneur Incubator. So I want you to think about this for just a second. What if you could get the training, support, tools, and community that you most needed to elevate both your life and your business without having to push pause on anything? What if you could love, and I mean love, every aspect of your life bravely and without apology while also embracing the discomfort and pain that comes along with growth and stepping into success as you've always desired? Well, friends, now you can. You really can. That is what the basis of the Brave Entrepreneur Incubator is all about. And I am actually living proof that change is possible, that you can have the life and the business that you most desire, and that it is a whole hell of a lot easier to do it in community when you have support, cheerleaders, people calling you on all your bullshit, and lots of support and accountability. Are you curious? Do you want to know more? I hope so. You can get all the details by visiting vickeryandco.com/incubator. Go check it out right now, vickeryandco.com/incubator, and then come back because holy hell do I have an episode for you today. Whew. Y'all, I am still speechless, and I know, that does not happen very often. Today's guest was once an undercover agent who worked inside Al-Qaeda to dismantle it from the inside. Tamer El-Nouri reminds us that it's what we do not know that scares us most. He reminds us to take time to get to know people, to understand their motivation and their hearts, and then you will understand what drives them, good or bad. His story is incredible. Tamer El-Nouri is not his real name. He is protecting himself, of course, but I learned so much in this conversation. I'm eager to share it with you. I'm so honored that this American hero chose to spend some time with us. So here we go. Thank you so much. You're listening to The Brave Files, where we share stories from people who've stepped out of fear and into bravery in every possible way. What we know for sure is that when we choose bravely on purpose, we choose bigger, we win bigger, and it's contagious. It's our hope that these stories connect with you and encourage you to embrace bravery in every possible way, day after day. Together, we can build a movement that enriches both our lives and our communities. The Brave Files is brought to you by Vickery & Co., a success and leadership coaching firm dedicated to helping you build a life and a business that you are absolutely in love with. Vickery & Co. offers group programs, membership communities, one-on-one coaching, VIP days, corporate trainings, workshops, keynote speaking, and so much more. Visit vickeryandco.com to get all the details. Tamer El-Nouri is not his real name. It's one of several aliases he's used throughout his career to infiltrate terror cells across the globe. His job was to decimate Al-Qaeda and ISIS from the inside out. He was required to put his arm around some of the worst people on the planet and convince them that he was their brother and their brother in arms, and then to ruin all of their plans of death and destruction without them ever knowing he was coming. Well, that's hard to say, Tamer. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Heather. Thank you so much for having me.
I mean, did you write that, or did just reading that and knowing you did that before we even get started? Like, my heart is pounding out of my chest. What's it feel like to write that?
It was surreal, actually, and it took me some time because it's hard to put into perspective the job that me and my fellow covert operatives have had to do, and that most Americans never knew about that line of work that we were in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so we've identified that nobody really knows who you are. That is for your safety and for your family's safety. So you're Tamer here with us today and publicly as well. But goodness, how did you become Tamer? Before all of that, I mean, how does one get into this line of work? My goodness.
Well, it all started me working undercover narcotics back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And when I first started, I was pretty awful. It's actually only by the grace of God and the amazing team I had behind me that I didn't die in those early years.
Wow.
When we're bad at something, it's easy to blame nerves or inexperience, but it was so much more than that. I went about everything the wrong way. I didn't prepare for these undercover assignments. I used to think I had all these biases and preconceived notions in my head, what the dealer was supposed to look like, what I was supposed to look like. I didn't know how to truly prepare properly. You can go through all the training. At the end of the day, you do have these preconceived notions of this world, and you find yourself leaning on some of these biases. It wasn't until I shed all of those biases and began to see this world, the undercover drug world, the narcotics world, through their perspective, that I was able to become successful as an undercover. I shed all my biases. And once I saw the world through theirs, I saw the world through the eyes of users and sellers, street level dealers, cartel bosses, and everyone in between, their families, their history, their tendencies, their motivations. That's when my undercover career took off.
So fascinating.
I loved my work and I was starting to get good at it, but then we got attacked.
Right.
And after 9/11, I had to shift gears.
Right. Well, let's hold on to that for one second, because you said something that gives me a lot of hope, but we don't hear a lot from law enforcement, which was acknowledgement of bias and preconceived everything, right? So first of all, I want to thank you as a fellow citizen of this nation for admitting that that's how we often approach situations, especially folks in law enforcement. How does one go about shifting that to shed those biases? And then when you approach and become better at your job because you understand, are you more patient? Are you more thoughtful? Are you more, right? Because when we understand systemic racism, when we understand how people get into the situation that they're in, it shifts how we engage with them.
Absolutely. And at the end of the day, not just law enforcement. Law enforcement are human beings.
Sure, of course.
Our soldiers, our CEOs, our baristas.
Absolutely.
We're all human beings.
Yeah.
And we all have these preconceived notions and biases that sometimes we don't even know that we have. Mm-hmm. And it isn't to say racism. It's simply the lack of knowledge of another culture or another human being or another person's point of view. And that's what I hope to get at. That's what I hope to get out in my book. And that's what I hope to get out in my speeches, is the power of human connection, the ability to see the world through someone else's eyes before you judge or decide or make a decision or make any action. That is a game changer. It sounds so much easier than it is, but the truth is, it's very hard for some of us with our life experiences to step outside of ourselves and see the world through someone else's eyes. But when you do that, you at least have an understanding. You don't have to agree with them. You don't even have to see things their way, but you understand. And that's what it took for me to be able to infiltrate these terror groups, these drug networks, is I had to see the world through their eyes. Obviously, I never had any intention of selling poison or committing mass murder.
Right.
Agenda and politics aside, the human connection part had to be real. Otherwise, we would never get anywhere and I would never have been successful at my job.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's fascinating. And you're right. Everybody has biases. I certainly also have them. We all have them. And a lot of really powerful, wonderful growth comes from acknowledging that those things exist. We have to be honest about it. We have to work with them. So you got really good at that job and you really enjoyed that work. And then 9/11, did you seek this work or did this work seek you after 9/11?
After the initial shock, I mean, 9/11 was personal to all of us, every single American.
Yeah.
But for me, it became a calling because I was in a very unique position to actually do something about it. I speak Arabic like I speak English, without the Jersey accent, of course. I know the true meaning of the religion. I know the culture. I know I was already in law enforcement with a significant amount of undercover experience. I knew I could help in some way, even if it meant just translating. I wasn't thinking about doing any of the covert stuff that I ended up doing. I just wanted to help because I felt that I needed to help, because some savage in a cave made me and my family the enemy that day. So it was very personal to me.
I get that.
So I seeked out the FBI initially, and they were drowning. They were taking on a whole new, they were just wrapping their heads around the new war we were in. They, up until that point, the FBI was a law enforcement agency. The wall between law enforcement and intelligence hadn't come down yet. So they hadn't even dove into that world properly, so to speak. After 9/11, they didn't have a choice. And a few years later, that's when I was recruited and trained by the FBI's National Security Covert Operations Unit.
So we don't know you. They folks can't see you. We have your face blocked out on all of the social media assets. And as we're sharing this interview with people, you are Muslim. Hence, this is, you felt, this is what you meant when you said you felt you'd been made the enemy. And I, while this little white girl has absolutely no firsthand experience with that, my uncle is Iranian. My cousins are half Iranian. And my male cousin instantly started getting profiled. He's a bigger guy. He's got a beard. He looks dark, you know, and the terror of that. You're right. I mean, oh, we're so afraid of what we don't know. And we don't know so much, as in not to say we don't know anything. There's so much that we don't know in the world.
That's very true.
Yeah. Goodness gracious. Okay. So what does your family say when you were like, I gotta do something. I've been recruited by, say it again, National Security.
The National Security Covert Operations Unit.
National Security Covert Operations Unit. That's a lot of words.
Yeah, we call it NCOS. It's in our world. Yeah. That's our nickname for it.
You have a family. You have a family that you treasure. And so this was very important work to you. It was personal. You knew you wanted to be part of, I don't know if there's a solution of the operation of making a difference. What does your family say?
They're very supportive. They were very supportive. My father to this day hasn't read my book. He refuses to read it until I retire because he worries.
Sure.
And, you know, the typical off the boat foreigner. My sister always just assumed until she read my book that I was in an office somewhere translating, because she didn't want to think about the fact that I could be in harm's way. But my immediate family was always very supportive. But truth be told, because of the security issues and the classifications of everything that I was working in the national security realm, they really had no idea where I was going, how long I would be gone. I would pop back and forth. And I think that actually helped us out a little bit.
Sure.
Because they didn't need to know at that point. They didn't really need to understand. And the truth is, they would have never even known, but not for this one case getting declassified for trial. And it gave me the opportunity to write American Radical, to deliver a message that's so near and dear to my heart, to the American people. Because you touched on it before, Heather, what we don't understand, ignorance in certain cultures or religions, that's what hurts us. We let, I'm trying to say it in the nicest way, we were oblivious to these horrible human beings living amongst us, as us, to defeat us. But when we got punched in the mouth already, and we saw this movie and we vowed to never see it again. And the way to get over it is not to profile every brown guy with a kufi as a Muslim, as a terrorist. Yeah. No, what you need to do is understand the major differences between the radical mindset and the true tenets of the religion. And only then, as Americans, we will now be able to tell you who's good, who's bad, because I'm educated. I know that guy's just religious. That guy, there's a couple of red flags, and that will help us to be able to keep ourselves safe so that they can never do that to us again.
Absolutely. But of course, you're very intimately involved. You can see those red flags. The average American who doesn't take the time to understand, everybody looks scary. The truth is, not only can there be, there are radicals in every religion, in every group. I mean, not to get too into the weeds with it now, but we're seeing it play out right now front and center on the stage in America, radical religion is attempting to take over and cause a lot of harm.
Agreed.
It's what happens if it goes unchecked and if we don't take that time to really understand and to know the difference. So you thought maybe you would translate some things, you would go in. Did you know a couple of years in when they really recruited you that you were going to actually be boots on the ground, arms around these very evil folks? Did you know that's what you were going to do?
Once I got my security clearances and I went through my training and the books were opened up to me, so to speak, that's not only did I know that, I was excited for it. Couldn't wait for the opportunity. Wow. To dive in. And man, did I.
Wow. So what's the first thing that you experience once you've gotten that security clearance and you're ready to dive in?
The first thing you experience is you can't mess this up. You better be on point, because it's important. I felt like I was drowning initially, because it was like drinking from a fire hose. Yeah. Remember how I mentioned to you, I didn't really know the drug world. And then I had to dive headfirst into it to understand it. It was the same. I thought, because, hey, I'm a Muslim. I know the culture. I know the religion. I speak Arabic fluently. I got this. I had no idea what the radical mindset and the radical world was like. I had to learn the fundamental differences between meeting the elements of a crime when I was stateside and simply gathering intelligence when I was abroad and overseas. We became these brand new hybrid agents. When we operate on U.S. soil, we put our law enforcement hats on and we collect evidence. We record meetings and phone calls with the bad guys, and we build a prosecutable case for the U.S. attorney. And if that case ever went to trial, we were protected under SEPA. So our identities were protected so we can continue to do our jobs. But when we're tasked with working overseas or abroad, we simply had to gather intelligence. So it was a whole new world for me to wrap my head around, in addition to learning all the tradecraft of all the different terror groups, how they moved, how they operated, how they communicated. I had to learn our tradecraft when I operated abroad. I had to learn all these fundamental differences and then dive in. So it was a process for me to understand. And then when that all happened and I felt somewhat ready and comfortable, I had to do my homework on all my potential subjects, my targets that I was about to meet, or we called bump, in the field. And that's when I became the scientist in that world.
Wow. And so were you learning all of this while doing this? Were you learning and putting yourself in danger at the same time? Or was this the learning curve prior to doing the actual work?
That's a great question. There was about 6 months of just pure, intense, headfirst learning the process, learning what I needed to do when I was operational, be it stateside or abroad. And once I had that under me, that's when I started jumping into some cases and things of that nature. And then it took off from there.
What most surprised you when you jumped in to your first case?
The lack of knowledge by both sides, good guys and bad guys. As an outsider coming in with context in the culture and the religion, I noticed initially when I first started, Heather, that some of the agents were very vague on the religion, the good side, the bad side. They didn't really understand. And then we would follow up on leads because some cable installer saw a prayer rug and things of that nature. So there was a lot of ignorance that I noticed on both sides. And the bad guys just wanting to wear a bad backpack because they saw something in the news about Israel. There was a lot of ignorance on both sides. I'm talking about the homegrown terrorists, not the sleeper cells or the Al-Qaeda operatives. But I watched that progress as well. I watched that turn into agents born and bred in the Midwest, knowing more about my religion than I did at some point, and becoming subject matter experts, not only in the good side, but the how it was twisted and changed. Right. That gave me hope that we were looking at things the right way. The bad guys evolved, unfortunately, and they have had our playbook. And that was a big reason why we needed to protect our identities, because if I did one case in the Midwest and then I went to trial and everybody saw my face and knew my real name, it was game over. I couldn't continue to do my job in the Bureau, and the government invested so much time, money, and energy into preparing us for this line of work. We became sort of an asset that they didn't want to release.
Absolutely. How many different aliases have you had?
About 17.
Okay. That's not as many as I anticipated. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, 17 that were fully backstopped, if you will. Like
solid,
that I could take anywhere. Yeah. There was a bunch of notional aliases that I had to use, but those were nothing. Yeah.
Gotcha. Check into a hotel as some random person or whatever. I don't know. I've watched too many spy movies. I don't know. I mean, no idea. Basing it all on what happens in The Flight Attendant. No, I'm kidding. Sorry. Little tension breaker there, folks, because this is really serious. Like, this is your job, has been your job, has been your life for a long time. Now you've written the book, American Radical. So then it's another layer of your job. And we'll get into more of this later, but now you're going into the speaker circuit. And so it permeates everything. Well, how do you break the tension? Goodness gracious. Like, how do you step away from all of that really intense work?
In my personal life or on stage?
Whatever.
On stage, I usually open up with a joke or two just because I know the subject matter and the material is heavy, but and it's intense. And especially if you've never read American Radical and you don't know the story of this particular case, it does punch in the gut. It's a reality check as far as Al-Qaeda and their operatives and what they're trying to do to us. But in my personal life, as of lately, I just try to disconnect completely from that world. I'm in executive management right now in law enforcement, and I do my job. And then when I'm out of there, I try to disconnect as much as I can. And my biggest hobby, my favorite hobby right now is golf. And that is great. When I'm out on a golf course, I am just outside of that world and I try to avoid it in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. I'm sure it's meditative. It's nice. Do you have any, what's the trick? So I think a lot of people would go on the golf course and they would still be thinking about this constantly. Is there anything that you do to allow yourself to detach and reset?
Yeah, I think there's, I feel like my mind is broken down sometimes like a serial killer. I don't mean that in a very bad way. I'm never hurt anyone. But if you looked at my closet when I was fully operational, it was like 17 different compartments, different types of clothes, different outfits, 17 different accordion folders of identities and stuff. And every time I took a case, depending on what case or what alias I'd be using, I would flip a switch. And it was imperative for me to flip that switch completely. So my true self, my government self, my personal self is in a box and it stays at home. I don't even have any of my clothing, my watch, everything is married to that alias. And I become that person from the second I get on the plane. And that I always refer to that as flipping the switch.
Sure.
And when I flipped that switch, I had to stay there. But when I came home, I just flipped the switch the other way and I dove into the other stuff and I put everything else away. That's how I survived and functioned mentally in order to never bring my family or my friends or my upbringing into my work. And it worked for me. I have that unique ability to do that. And when I do it now, does it work every time? Does the switch get broken? Of course, when there's a lot of intensity and a lot of things going on. Have I lost sleep, nightmares, things of that nature? Of course, that still happens today. But when I'm consciously able to flip a switch, I could flip it both ways.
I think that's a really incredible skill. It's code switching at its finest, to say the least. So I've been thinking, as we've been talking, as I've been listening to you, and you talk about really understanding the drug world, working through those biases and getting to know that and how it shifted your ability to do your job well. When we humanize people, we see them differently, usually for the positive. And so, you know, I can only imagine that you had more tenderness maybe for some of these folks, maybe not the cartel, right? But your average street dealer or whatever. And I'm wondering if that work shifted how you engage with those folks, and then what was different when you were literally infiltrating Al-Qaeda?
You hit the nail on the head. I had to connect with their humanity and not what they were doing or trying to do, right?
Yeah.
That's the key to doing any of this covert work. The most important thing is getting to know these people. So when I get a folder, a lot of times I'll be in a SCIF, a secret compartmented information facility, and I get top secret classified documents about my target. 9 times out of 10, nothing that is in those documents and nothing that would be said in a SCIF is going to help me to do my job. I don't care about any of that stuff. My job is to connect, to ingratiate myself with this person as a human being. All the other stuff will come later after the human connection is set. So for me to learn about, for example, in the book, Shaheb Essagayer, I didn't care that he was an Al-Qaeda. I mean, of course I did. Obviously, that's why I was getting in front of him in an undercover right. capacity. But none of that mattered or was going to help me in any way, shape, or form to tell me how bad he is, who he knows overseas, what he's planning to do, blow this up, kill this person. That's all well and good. We'll get to that. But that doesn't give me a direct line to connect with him. So I need to know what he's doing when he's not being a jihadi, when he doesn't think anyone's looking, his vices that he thinks no one knows about. These are the things I need to know so I can tailor make my legend or my alias to fit his life and needs. And that's always how it broke it down. It was a psychological puzzle for me. What does he need? What does he want to reach his goals? And if it fits any of my aliases, I tailor make it a little bit so that when we do get in front of each other during this bump, he chooses me.
Yeah. Does it ever, I know that you're excellent at your work. And so this is probably a really annoying question, but do the lines ever get blurred? You're spending so much time intimately knowing these folks. Does it ever really get difficult to then do your job because you've built a relationship with these folks?
Difficult, I guess you could say there's human emotions in play always. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it's an imperative nature. I have a built-in foundation of anger and hatred towards these people who are trying to kill innocents. Mm-hmm. They are so misguided. They are so wrong. They couldn't be more wrong. So the overwhelming life force that I have, regardless of the connections I make with these bad guys, is justice and keeping innocent people safe. Because no matter how I feel about them personally, at the end of the day, this individual is trying to kill thousands of innocent people, people that don't have anyone watching out for them, people in our country that are going about their day-to-day lives, relying on people like me to keep them safe. So it's a no-brainer. That wall, that those emotions, whatever, that's amateur hour in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. Wow. I can't imagine, I'm making assumptions here. Like, what's it like to walk down the street and be you? Are you constantly looking for the, because you're just you're describing us walking to our local coffee shop or going to the mall or taking our kids to school, which is dangerous these days anyway. Like, what are you different when you walk down the street than me?
I am. And I never knew that I was until it's been pointed out by friends and family regularly. So I try to hide it as best I can. It's not something you could shut off. You know, listen, when you have a bounty on your head, regardless of your training, I think you're always going to be a little bit more observant. You're going to be a little bit more aware of your surroundings. You're going to notice things. Most people in law enforcement and in government do that anyway. Mine just happens to be a little bit heightened because of the 27 years of doing this, but that's natural. Yeah. And I don't even see it or notice it anymore.
Sure. I mean, you're probably the safest person to walk down the street with. Your friends and family are like, annoying. Let's just take Tamar with us.
Or the most true. Annoying, one way or the other,
come on. All right, so you indicated that one of your cases became declassified so that it could go to trial. Did that end your boots on the ground Al-Qaeda infiltration because it was no longer safe for you to be doing that specific work or no?
No, because the SIPA protections that I mentioned earlier, SIPA stands for Classified Information Protection Act.
Okay.
What the U.S. government did brilliantly was to take all their NCAS operatives and classify them and make their identities to keep their identities safe. So if a case ever went to trial, like this one did, mm-hmm. even though this one happened to be an international terrorism case that was being tried in Toronto, Canada, the Canadians were gracious enough to offer me the same protections that I have here in the States. So they protected my identity. I got to testify, and I had to testify for 3.5 weeks. The media never took a picture of me. No one ever saw me. No one ever learned my true name. And I was in and out in that month of trial without anybody having any idea who I truly was. And I was operational shortly after that trial.
Wow. Now, how do you even do that? How do you show up? Somebody sees your face. Do you just wear disguise? Do you change your facial features? Like, how is that even possible?
They gave me, it was like the prime minister's security detail or something. So I was picked up from the airport. They flew me in a private airplane to Toronto. And the second I came off the plane, because there was a media circus surrounding this particular case, I would have, they called it a toque, which is great. I love Canadian terminology. It's basically a ski mask. Right?
Okay.
And I put
so you
that
look
on.
Like the bad guy.
I did. Exactly. And they covered me up and they took me to a safe house and they did the same thing back and forth. They brought me in through the back. The jurors signed non-disclosure agreements and there was nobody in the courtroom except for the bad guys and their attorneys, the judge, the prosecutors, and my FBI and RCMP team. Royal Canadian Mounted Police. That was it. And the media was shifted to another courtroom where they could hear what I was saying, but could never see me. And they weren't allowed to record my voice.
What about the bad guys though? They could see you?
Yeah, of course. Well, they saw me for a long time.
So they knew.
Exactly. So I know it gets confusing. People are like, wait a minute. When they saw my website, they're like, I could kind of tell your face. I go, listen, it isn't about my face. It's about my name. At the end of the day, I protect my face for facial rec issues, but they know what I look like. The bad guys know what I look like. They just don't know who I really am. They know me as any of my 17 aliases, but they don't know my true name. So they essentially, in theory, can't find me. That's the best part of it.
Wow. And so then this declassification is what led you to writing your book. Tell us a little bit about deciding to do that, what that writing process was like, and what's shifted for you since writing American Radical.
I had just came back from overseas and I was watching something on the news and one of the newscasters said it was right on the heels of a terror attack by ISIS in Europe. And they said, how many millions of Muslim Americans are there? Why don't they stand up and denounce these attacks? Why aren't we hearing from them? And I know we're trained, Heather, to, you know, just disregard a lot of the negativity you hear in the media. But for whatever reason, that struck a chord, maybe because I'm getting older and whatever.
Have.
And it bothered me because of where I'd just come from and what I was doing and how many Muslim Americans that I work with that work to protect our country. My sister refuses to say the name ISIS or Al-Qaeda in the same breath because she's appalled at the fact that they're associated with our religion. My father prays for their death and destruction every day, but they don't have a voice.
Right.
And on the heels of that declassification and the trial had just ended, I reached out to FBI Security Division, pre-pub, and asked if I could tell the story. And because it was declassified, they said yes. But we would have to look at it before it was released. And that's when the ball got rolling.
Wow. Okay. So they said, yes, you got the go ahead. What was your writing process like? And it's really fast. This is a weird tie-in. I'm currently reading The Body Keeps Score, which is a really excellent book about how we overcome trauma and PTSD and things like that. And they talk a lot about folks who have been in war, been on frontline stuff. And I just as I was coming up to do this interview, he started talking about the power of writing and journaling and how when we do this, it sort of shifts us. We gain awareness and clarity. And so I don't know if that was true for you or not, but what was that process like?
Absolutely. And I probably wouldn't even have put it in those terms until you said it the way you did, because it was, looking back on it now, it was a remarkable experience. Penguin Random House, Dutton, hooked me up with Kevin Maurer, my co-author. They made him sign a non-disclosure before the poor guy even got on the phone with me. He gets on the phone with me. We speak for over an hour. I realize he's my guy. And his process was brilliant. I learned so much from him, and he's unique in every way. But every day I finish work, whether it was with the Bureau, my own other agency, I'd stuff a sandwich down my throat, go to the park, put my headset in, and Kevin and I would speak for about an hour and a half, give or take. We did each chapter separately after the outline was put together. We would discuss, he would write, I would write, we'd exchange back and forth, I'd get the chapter, we'd clean it up and move on to the next. And we did that for about 7 months. I wrote, and a couple of chapters I wrote myself and sent to him, and vice versa. So
yeah.
Because there were certain aspects and whatnot, and there were certain classification issues we had to kind of dance around and not say the certain things. And after about 7 months, we got the manuscript to the FBI, and it was approved within 30 days with a few changes. They made a few changes about my identity. That was very helpful, and a couple of things
yeah,
here and
right.
there that I didn't even notice I did. Then Penguin got it, and they hadn't read a word. Dutton hadn't read a word of my manuscript because they weren't allowed to.
Oh, wow.
Until the FBI reviewed it. And they really didn't know what they were getting other than the 20 minutes I sat with their VP of publishing, who gave me the contract. So it wasn't until then that they realized what the story actually was. And that's when 60 Minutes got involved and yep. all that sort of thing. So,
yeah. Wow. I mean, it sounds like, first of all, just as a writer, and I'm thinking about the content of your book versus my book's over my shoulder. Those of you listening can't see it, but my book, Fuck Fearless, was like, man, I feel like a lightweight. after writing that. But as a writer, I mean, it's a really great process. And, you know, folks, you don't even have to have a co-writer supporting you to use that kind of system. It's a smart system, but it is very therapeutic, for lack of a better word.
No doubt. Absolutely is. And looking back on it now, it was funny because I found myself very similar to the trial. And I would look at some of the bad guys' faces when they were listening to some of the recordings and the happy, quote unquote, happy moments that we had together. And I could see people reliving, the bad guys reliving those times. It was therapeutic for me because there was a lot that happened towards the end of Operation Dire Wolf. And that was painful to a lot of us. There was a lot of, you know, the media painted it as a win, you know, a first of its kind. They said a cross-border law enforcement and intelligence operation that led to the successful disruption of multiple terrorist plots in two countries. But there was a handful of us that didn't view it as a win. And that was important for me to get that out, for the world to understand the challenges that we have and what we viewed as success.
That's incredibly poignant. It reminds me of a line from the second season of Handmaid's Tale. We don't have to get too far into it, but she's figured it out, right? She's figured out all of the insidious stuff that went down to get them where they were. And she said, nothing bad is ever bad for everyone.
That's so true.
And I think about that all the time. And it feels like it was probably a win in a lot of ways. And yet, and you just got to read the book. You got to read the book to hear Tamara's perspective.
That. Yeah. And especially with this operation, I can see that. None of the terror plots came to fruition, thankfully. I can see that.
Thank goodness.
But there was a lot of other reasons that you saw getting a rug pulled out from under us at the end, where I can make the argument it wasn't a win. There was a lot of meat on that bone.
Yeah, there was more you felt that you could do.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So you went right back into the field, but you're not in the field now. You said you have a, I don't want to use the word desk job, right? But you're in management now.
Yeah, oh, trust me, it's as desk job as it gets. I run a lot of the operations side of the house. I still train a lot of my undercovers. I run a bunch of task forces and things of that nature. So I get to live vicariously through my guys. But at the end of the day, I'm just reviewing ops plans. I'm barely in the field anymore.
Do you miss it?
I miss the camaraderie and the work and getting in it. But no, not as much as I thought I would. And I'm looking to retire in the very near future as well and turn the page. So I think, I guess ask me this time next year and I'll let you know.
No, but that makes a lot of sense. I personally, I'm thankful, very thankful for all of the work that you've done and the way that you have put yourself on the line to protect all of us and really in the whole world. But I could see maybe a sense of relief, right? It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't realize when you're in it. At least it took me until writing American Radical that I realized that I was a bit of an adrenaline junkie. I thrived on pressure. I thrived on things not going smoothly, almost as a mental challenge to myself. I'm sure if I was younger now, I would have been classified with some sort of learning situation because I got bored very easily. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But back in the 70s, they didn't have programs like that.
So Tamar has ADHD. Is that what you're telling us?
That's exactly what I'm telling you. So I needed to be challenged and pushed or else I got bored really quick. So yes. So I think the exhaustion after the fact and thinking about how bad so many things could have gone. And honestly, Heather, some of my proudest moments in my career, ones that I think about from time to time, no one's ever going to know about. No one's ever going to hear about it. No one will ever see that. And that is okay. I don't care. Like this case, Operation Dire Wolf, sure, it was declassified. So I got to give you the meat and potatoes of an actual case and tell you how it works and tell you about the heroes that are there to protect America. And it was a cool story, fun story, great. And this is how it planned out. And this is how it worked out, rather. But the other stories that I'll never be able to tell is what I'm most proud of. And I will take with me for the rest of my life that I can rest my head on a pillow saying, I was fortunate here. I was lucky here. And it was great.
Oh, that's really beautiful. Of all of the wild, insane situations you found yourself in, when have you found yourself feeling the most brave? I mean, that's an alternate question to what has scared you the most, but this is the brave file. So we talk about like, when did you know, like, motherfucker, this, I am brave. Like, this is some brave shit.
It's funny because the overall concept of my job, I wouldn't classify as being brave. And I'm not being humble or modest in any way, shape, or form. And I said this in a couple of interviews when the book came out. It isn't bravery. Again, it goes back to those words that I mentioned. It was an obligation that I had. I happened to be in law enforcement. I speak Arabic. I'm a Muslim. I have no choice but to do it. And what the government did was take me in and protect me taking those skill sets and assets, and they protected me more than they would protect anybody else so that I was safe while embedded in these cells. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was just a matter of getting on target and doing the job, if that makes sense.
Yeah. All right. Well, so then when have you felt the most brave in your life, if that wasn't it?
That's a great question. I guess bravery for me isn't about being scared and overcoming, even though that's the actual Webster's definition. For me, it has to do with the ability and sacrifice that you give to others. So in my particular situation, it's always been towards my family, my children. And things that I've done there without getting into specifics, I would say that would be the bravest I was able to be was for my children. But as far as my work was concerned, sure, you can call it bravery. And there are certain situations and cases that I will never forget about that I did some, looking back on it now, idiotic, stupid shit, and I should be dead.
I'm not laughing that you should be dead. It's not funny.
No, it's true. It's seriously, like, I think back on some of the chances I took and the things that I've done and how I'm sitting here today. Every now and then I laugh. But yeah, that I guess that would be the idiotic bravery part. But the true bravery came from things with my children.
I love that. Because it's so much the work that I do is reminding folks that those really most powerful moments of bravery are not the ones that you would think they are.
Yeah. You're so exactly right. I couldn't agree more.
It's a nice lead into a question that I get to ask in every single episode of The Brave Files, which is how do you like to celebrate successes and wins in your life? I mean, how the hell do you celebrate when you're in an Al-Qaeda? Woo!
Yeah. Again, circling back to some of those cases I can't discuss.
Yeah.
I go back when things work out the way we hoped, when we get the bad guys, some of the really bad guys, and you put in a ton of time and effort and thought into accomplishing that goal that sometimes feels unattainable. When it does happen, me and my team, we sit down alone in a private area and we reflect and we kick things back. I brought that to my narcotics task force after my counterterrorism days. It's almost like a debrief, but it's more fun. Like a debrief is more official.
Yeah.
Let's break it down. Let's put it in. This is what's going in the file. It's a fun debrief. Let's talk about it. Let's let it all out. What worked, what didn't work. And we have fun with it. And we relish in the success. I started doing that back at the narcotics task force and it worked. And that's what I did in counterterrorism, because it gave you a minute to accept the win, because how much do we beat ourselves up when we lose?
Absolutely. That is beautiful. And I love to know that that approach is being used in just the way you said it, right? We do beat ourselves up and we have to pay attention. Like that we did this hard work and this thing happened and it was good. And could it have been different or maybe better or whatever? Yes, but that's not relevant right now. Like we have to own that win and honor it. It gives you that momentum to get back in the ring and do it again, right?
Yes, absolutely right.
I just had a question pop in my mind as we're very close to wrapping this, and this is not a wrap question, but I'm going to kill myself if I don't ask. I'm not going to kill myself. I'm going to beat myself up if I don't ask it. Where were you and how did you feel when we found out that Osama bin Laden had been killed?
I was home and it was pure elation. It was relief that lasted for about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Because knowing the organization, knowing that he was just a symbol at that point, because he wasn't running the show, knowing that there might be the crazies coming out of the woodwork.
Fallout, yeah.
And the fallout and the way things played out, it went from pure elation to pure fear almost instantaneously. But nonetheless, it was a great win.
Yeah, I get that. I think even from my perspective, just as your average American citizen, I felt that as well. And I personally struggle with celebrating anyone's death. Like that feels to me like crossing a line. Like I don't want those bad guys out there. I want them to be stopped, but also something really gross about celebrating death. I remember seeing the images of President Obama. Like that, I don't know, it had to be intense. Did you have any insider knowledge that that was coming?
No. I did not. They kept that very, very tight-lipped.
I bet they did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so you have a book out, American Radical. How can people find it?
I'm on Amazon, and I'm on Penguin Random House's website. If you Google American Radical Tamriel Nouri, I'm everywhere. As far as the images that are out there, obviously that isn't my real face. People got very confused when I did the interviews on the news and 60 Minutes.
You did full prosthetics for 60 Minutes, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It felt like I was wearing a helmet, Heather. It was 5.5 hours in a chair, and those guys did an amazing job, and they it literally felt like wearing a helmet. It was fake hair, fake beard. It was crazy. They did a really nice job.
Yeah, it's a really great segment. We'll put it in the show notes. You can all go and check it out. So this next phase of your life, you said you're going to retire soon. Check back in, see if you're feeling quote-unquote bored then. You've indicated public speaking. What are you hoping will be this next phase of your life?
I am. We're in talks right now with optioning the rights to American Radical for potential television show, which would be exciting to get a message out. And it's all about getting that message out that the whole reason why I wrote American Radical is to tell the story of not only the heroes and the patriots that are doing this work, but also the bad guys, how they think, why they think it, what their reasons are for wanting to hurt us, how they infiltrate us, and what the fundamental differences is between the really bad guys and the homegrown bad guys, or the true operatives that were born and raised to come hurt us. So I'm excited, and that's why I decided to delve into public speaking as well. Which is funny, because someone in the bureau said to me, well, you can never be a public speaker. And that's pretty much all I needed, because all you have to do, as you know, apparently I have ADHD, as I was just recently diagnosed on this show.
I'm not a doctor. I just am an undiagnosed ADHDer myself with a couple of ADHD kids. That's all.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. So all you have to do is tell me that I can't do something. And it just makes me figure out a way. And I think I have. I get to tell my story on stage with a hat and sunglasses. And I explain that immediately in the opening of my speech. And I get to discuss the power of human connection while telling you the story of Operation Dire Wolf. It's pretty cool. And I've done it a handful of times already in front of some big audiences. And I've been very humbled by the response.
Absolutely. It is pretty cool. And it is wild to think that somebody who's spent the majority of his life not being publicly out there, that's now the work that you're doing. And I would imagine there are a lot of hoops to jump through from a security standpoint, from a safety standpoint, to keep your real identity a secret.
There absolutely is. And a lot of times, if an event planner is interested in having me, we just make sure it's certain things are in place. And if that's the case, we dive right in, and my team is always there to make sure everything goes safely.
I think that's so cool. I would love the opportunity to see you speak live.
I would love that.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Absolutely. That isn't something, though, you're not doing like book tour things, right? So people are hiring you to come in and speak to their private organization.
That's correct.
Public way to come see you speak.
No, that's correct. At this point, no, we're not. Advertising is a little tough for me. We've had several requests that we had to kind of unfortunately decline. But for the most part, if a private corporation or a business or a company or a charity or whatever wants, they just go to my website and they link up with us. And as long as it fits our mold as far as security protocols, mm-hmm. we don't say no to anyone unless there's security issues.
Right.
And if it fits that mold, we love it. We love telling this story. We love spreading this message. I love signing books for people. It's a passion, and I look forward to continuing doing that.
That's beautiful. You look excited. For those of you who are listening, which is everybody, because I promised Tamara that we would not put any video out, but even now it's dark. Like, I can kind of see you, and I for a minute I was like, oh, it's so dark there. Then I'm like, oh, he did that on purpose. it took me a second. I was like, your lighting's bad. Oh, wait. No, that's a really great segue into a question that's near and dear to my heart, which is, what is your favorite charitable organization to support?
Everything having to do with hunger, children's hunger, world hunger. I'm very passionate about that. And I'm also very passionate about the Folds of Honor. It's a program that was created about 15 years ago now that provides support, financial support, scholarships to the spouses and children of military, fallen military or disabled veterans. And they've recently done that, are now doing it for law enforcement and fallen law enforcement families. It's a wonderful organization. Everything they do is to support the ones who supported our heroes. I love it. I love any opportunity I get to support them in any way. I jump all over it, because it's such an honorable group of men and women that really take care of our heroes and our heroes' families.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds really important, like a really excellent organization. So for those of you who don't know them, we'll put links here. Go and check them out. Give whatever you can, right? That's what I say every episode. If it's time, money, social media shares, likes, think about it for the people in your life who might need it. So thank you, Tamara, for introducing them to us. They'll be our charity of the week this week.
Oh, thank you. It means a lot. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Will you share your three words with us one last time?
Obligation, opportunity, pride.
Incredible three words. I think that you've done a stellar job of explaining why those are the words that you picked. And your pride, we can hear it. Even mm-hmm. though your face is shadowed, I can see it. I can feel it in your energy. And I'm sure that's what you bring to the stage. I hope folks will grab your book. We have e-copies. I need to get my hands on a hard copy. Maybe we'll get a chance to have you sign it sometime.
Oh, I promise. I'll get one to you ASAP.
We would love that. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for being here. Thank you for all of your sacrifice for our safety. And I'm really touched and honored. It's been such a joy.
Oh, thank you so much, Heather. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. You're amazing. Big fan. Thank you.
Thank you. Absolutely. Wow. Wow, everyone. Wow. Are you all as speechless as I am? Tamara's story it's incredible. The sacrifices he's made, the work that he's done for all of our safety. I got the joy of having sort of a more in-depth, relaxed conversation with him afterwards. Not that we weren't relaxed in the interview, but some things that he couldn't really say on the record. And I just have to tell you, he is the neatest guy who is so heart-centered. And it is such a joy to be able to bring him here to all of you so that you can know. I was really particularly moved by this notion that what we don't understand hurts us. And I feel like we can apply that in so many different ways in our life. What we don't understand hurts us. So that includes things as crazy and intense as, you know, radical mindsets, but it also includes how we look at our lives day to day, how we're feeling, what we're thinking, what our choices are, what our actions are. What we don't understand hurts us. It's actually the core of the Brave Method, right? It's all about understanding ourselves, our dreams, our desires, and then leaning from there, starting from there. Absolutely beautiful. I hope that you all really enjoyed this episode. Go and get your copy of American Radical. It's incredible. And I'm super hopeful that this does get made into a TV show or a movie, because I think it's something that the world needs to see. I want to remind you all that I do a live show every single Wednesday, 1:30 p.m. Central. You can catch that on YouTube, which is youtube.com/HeatherVickery, or find me on Instagram. My tag on Instagram is @VickeryandCo. And if you are touched, inspired, moved, or motivated by any of the content that I put out there, you can say thanks by buying me a coffee. It's pretty easy. You visit VickeryandCo.com/say thanks, whatever you want to contribute. And as a thank you for your thank you, I'll give you a little love here on the podcast, either on the live show or in my weekly newsletter. So I would be super grateful for anything that you want to contribute there if the work is really moving you. Until I get a chance to talk to you again, it is my honor and my privilege to bring you these incredible stories of people who are out every single day, living bravely, choosing bravely. This is Heather Vickery reminding you every single day to go out and choose bravely. Talk to you soon, folks. Bye. You've been listening to The Brave Files, stories of people living courageously. Visit us at thebravefilespodcast.com to learn more about the show, find our show notes, and access full episode transcripts. And we'd love to know what you think of the show. We invite you to connect with us via Instagram and send a DM. You'll find us at The Brave Files Podcast on Instagram. Our music was created and produced in a custom collaboration with Matt Lewis from ML Creative Consulting, a boutique firm dedicated to helping clients identify their unique sound and amplify their brand with custom-delivered soundtracks. Special thanks to everyone on Team Brave, from our audio engineer to our producers, associate producers, copy editors, writers, and support team. The show wouldn't exist without them, and we are eternally grateful. I'm your host and executive producer, Heather Vickery. Thanks for tuning in.